Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it is Friday, March 8th, 2019. I'm Jeff Tiberi. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. And today we're chatting with Becky Gray and Rob Schofield, as we occasionally do on the podcast. A programming reminder that you can hear a similar version of this conversation wrapping up the North Carolina week in political news each Friday at 4:50 on All Things Considered on 91.5 FM or at our website, WUNC.org. Becky Gray in from the John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from NC Policy Watch. Hey there.
Hi, Jeff. Good to be with you.
Governor Roy Cooper detailed his fiscal plan for the state on Wednesday. He called for a nearly 5.5% increase in overall state spending, an expansion of Medicaid, an average 9% raise for teachers, and a one-time modest increase for retired state employees. Cooper acknowledged he won't get everything in the budget proposal, but does feel he has more leverage with the absence of supermajorities. GOP leaders criticize the plan for being overly political and unrealistic. The governor does not increase any taxes in the plan, though there are some new assessments on hospitals. Rob, how is he going to pay for this?
Well, he's got his experts in the budget office who figured out a way to do it with existing revenues. He talked about, you know, we've got to live within our means. I would argue that it was a missed opportunity to address the sort of upside down and inadequate tax code that we have in North Carolina. We have been essentially implementing structural deficits for a long time because of the tax cuts we've implemented on the wealthy and profitable corporations. And the fact that the governor chose not to go after that, I think, may have been a missed opportunity. I think he may just have, you know, taken the position, well, I'm not going to get this, so I'm not going to bother. The reality is that we have the money, at least for the short term, to afford the budget that the governor has proposed. But I do think that in the long run, it's still whether we adopt the governor's budget or we adopt the budget that the General Assembly will propose as an alternative, either one still faces this structural deficit issue that is the result of the tax cuts we've implemented in recent years.
Quick follow-up. Go after the tax code. How? Increase personal? Increase corporate? I mean, what exactly could the governor propose?
Sure. All of those things. I mean, the reality is that right now, and governor's budget officer, Charlie Peruse, mentioned this in his presentation this week, right now we are $4 billion lower than we would be if we just left the tax code where it was when we were already attracting business to the state at a record pace. North Carolina already had a very the recovery was underway when we started slashing taxes. We'd have billions of dollars more for the essential structures and services that we need in the state. Our state, even with the governor's proposals in education, we're still spending less than we did before the recession on per pupil expenditures in education. We've got all kinds of needs. We've got the school bonds needs. We've got water and sewer and infrastructure, all these things the governor's proposed. Again, he's got some ways to sort of balance the books for a year or two, but long term, I think we still face some real problems.
I commend the governor for not having tax cuts in the budget. I think the governor recognizes what the transformational changes have resulted. And it's not just the tax cuts. It's also reining in the growth of government so that the both sides of the ledger match up, rolling back regulations, better, smarter investments in infrastructure and education. All of those things have led to real economic growth in North Carolina. And I think the governor recognizes that. With economic growth, you have more people working, you have more revenue coming in, all of those things. And I think that the governor recognizes that. But, Jeff, this whole notion of the governor's budget and what it means and is it political, I mean, the governor is really in kind of an enviable position in that he can make big, bold political statements in his budget knowing that the General Assembly is not going to accept his whole proposal. As a matter of fact, I've even thought, what would he do if they said, oh, okay? Because I think there's some things in there that are untenable over the years. I mean, Rob mentioned teacher pay increases for state employees, those kind of things. One thing you always have to think when you implement that is it's not just for this year. When you give somebody a raise, that goes on forever. So you have to make sure that that flow of income is to pay for it, not just this year when things are going really well, but you have to be careful and do it in, I believe, in smaller steps to ensure that you're going to be able to sustain those pay increases raises and pay raises through the years. And, you know, he has that proposed. The General Assembly has also given pay increases for teachers and state employees over the years. But again, no matter who's doing it, it needs to be done carefully and in a way that, to the extent that we can predict things out, make sure that we can make good on those new commitments that we make.
You, quick follow-up for you. You just mentioned that you like something that's not in the budget, which would have been tax increases. What's something in this proposal that you like?
One of the things that I like is that the governor has recognized the importance of putting money aside to replenish that $2 billion rainy day fund that we have, and he has some money to put back into that. I like that. One of the things that concerns me is the growth in the spending. Jeff, you mentioned in the introduction that his proposal is 5.5% growth over last year. Again, this whole notion of reining in the growth of government at the same time decreasing taxes is what has led to the economic growth and the economic engine in North Carolina. Over the last 8 years, the budgets have averaged about 2.5% increase in spending. This proposal increases at 5.5%. I think that's too big of a jump.
So I want to hear from Rob here in a second, and he might go in this direction, but I want to ask you, because if I'm remembering correctly, in recent budget cycles, the growth has not kept up with inflation plus population growth. So to some, it hasn't been enough of growth, of expansion.
Some would argue that.
Is 5.5% perhaps playing catch-up to years that didn't grow as much as some economists say it should have?
Well, the number for growth plus population this year, and there's a little bit of a difference in the estimates of that, but it's about 3.9%. So if you want to keep the growth of government in check with inflation plus population and not get out in front of your headlights, if you will, again, being able to sustain the commitments that you've made to the programs and to state employees and those kind of things, it's important to keep it in that range.
The best way to measure what we're spending on government in the state is to compare it to our total personal income for the state. And when you do that, when you combine state and local government spending in North Carolina and compare it to the growth and the size of our total personal income, we're at like a 45-year low. And that is not having good effects on our economy. Sure, we have some boom areas in the urban areas, but the truth is because of our systematic underinvestment in rural infrastructure, which is something the governor, to his great credit, emphasizes in his budget, those areas are being left behind. We're not building the infrastructure they need. We're not making the investments that we need to keep those areas coming along. So, in fact, our economy, there was a great op-ed in Raleigh's News and Observer this week explaining how so many areas of our economy are actually struggling greatly, and you can draw a direct line between that and the systematic underinvestment in government, and we're at a 45-year low, and I think that we need, I think the governor's right to start pushing that in a different direction. I think you should have gone further.
Well, I don't think there's any question that we have an issue in North Carolina. There's issues of this in other states as well, but it's the division between the urban and rural areas and meeting the needs across the state. This is a challenge. Many believe that the best way to address that is to offer good workforce training programs through the community college, ensure that through our public schools those are offered, to offer a low tax rate base across the board that is attractive to companies to expand in North Carolina, to come to North Carolina, to set up business and to hire people, and to make opportunities available for entrepreneurs and investments and all of those kind of things.
Much more to come on the budget in the months ahead. I do believe that the House will go first this year, followed by the Senate. Feel free to correct me if that's wrong. I reserve the right to be mistaken on that. But similar to the federal government, just as the president does not allocate money, even if he tries to, the fiscal levers are pulled by Congress, and here they're pulled by the legislature. So while this is a relevant conversation to have, Governor Cooper does not actually allocate any money. And this will live on the web in the podcast, but it is occasionally referred to in our political bubble in Raleigh as the heaviest doorstop in the state is the governor's.
We're just getting started.
You hear, just getting started. Let's revisit the case of State House Representative Cody Henson. Last month, the Transylvania County Republican was accused of harassing his estranged wife, and a protective order was issued against him. Last week, that protective order was extended for 1 year. This week, a criminal summons was also issued. There's a court date set for later in the month. A judge has ruled that Henson, who has two young children, did not make threats toward his wife, but did harass her. Becky, should Representative Henson resign?
Well, I don't think that's up to me. I think that's up to Representative Henson, to his family, but more importantly to the voters in that district who have elected him. And probably the leadership of the General Assembly to advise or perhaps give direction in one way or the other. I think that there is a standard that we expect from elected officials. That's one reason why I believe so heavily in our two-year election system, in that, you know, every 2 years, every member of the General Assembly is reapplies for that job, if you will. I have tremendous confidence in the voters across North Carolina, but I think if he is going to resign, that really needs to come from his district, from his voters, and certainly within his family.
But we're 20 months away from the next election. Should that be voided, his reapplication, based on what has happened here?
Well, I think
you just said there's a standard. Has he violated that standard?
That's really up to the voters to decide. I mean, in my view, yes, he has, but I don't live in that district. And so I think that has to come from the voters who elected him. And if there is pressure within that district, whether that's party leaders, whether that is just voters in the district, whether that's within his family and his circle of network. But I think that needs to be left to him. But I think these are the kind of things that absolutely need to be considered as we consider different candidates for elected office.
Yeah, obviously, I agree that with you, Jeff, that this 20 months away from the election, that's just not going to, in this case, that's not going to work. I think there's been a change a little bit in the General Assembly under the leadership of Speaker Tim Moore. I think he's been less interested in intervening in these kinds of matters. When Representative Paul Stamm was still around at the General Assembly, I didn't agree with him on much, but if there was any kind of an allegation of a morals violation or some sort of illicit or illegal behavior by a lawmaker, they were out. The Republicans would get rid of their own members who do this and who were accused of such things. And Speaker Moore seems less inclined to do that. From what I've been able to read from listening to some of the 911 tapes, this is a badly troubled young man who needs to get some help. And it seems to me that he clearly needs to resign ASAP. And I can't imagine that it won't happen pretty soon.
I really agree with Rob. And, what we've seen in the past, I mean, unfortunately, these similar type situations have arisen over the years. And often it is handled just, you know, within a caucus with senior leadership advising members, younger members, that perhaps the time has come. And again, I think those things need to play in to how this is resolved.
Just a quick response from each of you. Would you agree that the optics of this look bad for both the North Carolina General Assembly and anybody who really works there and calls that place home, as well as the Republican Party, the party occasionally of family values? Is it fair to say that this reflects badly on both of those, the party and the institution?
I think that is absolutely fair, and I think it is accurate.
Yeah, I was trying to think of, let's say you're someone who wanted to go see your lawmaker about, I don't know, domestic violence legislation or something that had to do with protecting innocent individuals. How could you possibly go and lobby it or speak to a lawmaker who's in a situation like this? He's made his position in the General Assembly untenable, and I do think it reflects badly on the General Assembly to have someone like that serving.
And finally, let's move to the U.S. House, where Mark Walker has introduced a bill pertaining to college athletics. Walker is a Republican who covers parts of Greensboro and High Point, his district, that is. He wants so-called amateur student athletes, that's an ironic moniker, to be able to make money off of their likeness. As college athletics has grown into a multi-billion dollar annual business, coaches, administrators, executives, broadcasters, and plenty of others are making lots and lots of money. The athletes, not so much. What do you make of Walker's plan?
These things never go anywhere. There are always bills introduced in Congress to intervene in professional sports and amateur sports. They send a message that's a symbolic gesture. There's no way that this is going to pass Congress. College sports is obsolete almost. I'm a huge sports fan, and I think it's gotten to the point where it's just absurd. Clearly, the athletes need to be able to be paid, but to do it in the context of a university, you can see where a university would be concerned about that, where a supposed athletic association, an amateur athletic association, would be concerned about that. So I just think it points to the fact that big-time college sports have become obsolete, and I think eventually athletes will be paid, but it will be... It's hard to imagine how you reconcile that with the notion of representing a university. It just seems an anachronism, an obsolete situation.
I agree with Rob. I think that college athletes have made themselves obsolete. And, you know, thinking through this, and our listeners probably don't know this, but you two know this. When you two start talking sports is usually when I pull my phone out and start checking my emails. But I think this really ponders a different sort of deeper question of, you know, if college sports are obsolete, then what are we going to do about it? And are we going to keep them within our university system, asking what is the core function and what is our expectation for our universities and for higher education? You know, it used to be, I mean, decades ago, there was sort of a contractual agreement between a student athlete and the college and the athletic program, in that that student was offered a education at a university that they might not otherwise have available to them, whether that was because of financial or perhaps because of academic achievement. But that was the deal, that they would be offered a free education in exchange for playing a sport. And what the university got out of that was to build their sports programs and to, you know, have something fun for alumni to do on the weekends and maybe boost some fundraising kind of things. And what the athlete got out of it was, at the end of those 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, they had a college education that was something that they could go out into the world and have an opportunity to make a living and all of those kind of things. Well, over the decades, it seems like that has, that contract, the terms of that contract have greatly changed, and that what we're dealing with now is, it seems like the contract is that a college athlete gets to come to a university and play a sport that is really a training ground and an opportunity for them to shine and really show what they're about and to excel in order to be placed in a professional sports team, where they have the opportunity at the end of that contract to make a bunch of money. And, you know, the sports that I think usually this is really, you know, we're not talking about girls volleyball. Right. We're talking about those big revenue football.
Men's basketball and occasionally women's basketball.
Right.
So hold the angry emails about softball or college wrestling.
Right.
I appreciate your fandom, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Those aren't
these are the big business sports. And so, you know, what this has ended up with is really being a training ground and sort of a minor league teams for the NFL and the NBA. Now, that all may be fine, but is that a core function that we want our higher education system to fulfill? Or should it go to, I mean, if you think about the baseball players, and this has changed a little bit over the years too, but, you know, for the professional baseball industry, they have minor league teams that, you know, a kid can go and play right out of high school. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think they even have to necessarily have a high school degree.
I don't believe
you
so.
Know, that's open, but the Baseball Association funds all of that, and that's their training ground to find those better players and to position them to play in those big leagues and make the big money. What it appears to me is the NBA and the NFL has figured out a way to have those training grounds, but they have the universities paying for it. So the question and the bill that Representative Congressman Mark Walker has proposed of who's going to benefit from all this money, I think, isn't really the core questions and the core problem that we're looking at. And maybe, to Rob's point, of the reason why these things are introduced over the years and everybody says, yeah, we ought to do something about it, is they're kind of looking at chipping around the edges of the problem and not really going to the core question of, is this a function of higher education?
Last question, is anybody actually making that argument? I mean, I think people will recognize that this is a crap load of money, but is anybody saying that this is or should be a core function of university? I almost feel like we could find close to consensus on this isn't a core function of the university, or are people saying that?
Well, I don't know that you'd find consensus that people want to stop tailgating at NC State Wolfpack games and you give up their tradition of supporting their college team when it comes to therein is a huge problem. It's hard to imagine how you would ever do away with that system.
But people aren't talking about doing away with college athletics, are they?
Big time college athletics. Well, I think that's what we're basically saying, is that it's become the notion of having, they are professional sports, and it's silly to consider it an amateur sport, college football, college basketball. And it, to my way of thinking, it makes sense that these athletes should be paid, but to pay them while they are representing a university just sort of, I mean, as Becky mentions, there's the minor league baseball model. In Europe, soccer, football, what they call it there, they're club sports. It's not done through colleges. They would find our system of using big-time colleges and universities as sort of like perplexing. And it's hard to imagine how it survives in the long run, from my perspective.
I agree with what you just said. I would note that it would be interesting to turn back the hands in time and see if somebody would think, you know, in 1975, hey, if the head coach, the head basketball coach at Duke in the year 2019 is making between $10 and $11 million, what do you think of that? Yeah. I think 40 years ago someone would have said, that's nuts. Like, that's not ever going to happen. Well, here we are.
When right. I went to UCLA back in the day, and John Wooden had just retired as the head coach at UCLA, and during part of his tenure as the basketball coach there also taught English, I think his highest salary was under $100,000 a right. year. It was probably $50,000 or $60,000 a year. So, yes, times have
but
definitely
hence the
changed.
Problem. I mean, you know, when you're talking about these kind of salaries, when you're talking about, I mean, the tens of millions, probably billions of dollars that are involved in these programs and the NCAA and, you know, all of this, you know, it's hard to unravel it. And there is the argument to be made, you know, as Rob made, you know, do kids choose to go to Duke because they saw Duke win the national championship the last time they did? You know, do they want to be a Cameron crazy? Do they want to attend, you know, do people go to Chapel Hill because they want to attend a football game on a beautiful fall afternoon? You know, and where is the money coming from? I mean, you know, alumni who graduate from those programs, not the student athletes, but, you know, the doctors, the lawyers, the architects, you know, the social workers, the teachers, the people that graduate from those programs and have pride in their schools, you know, are contributing a lot of money to it. So it's a complicated thing. And I think that's one reason why nothing really seems to be able to get accomplished, despite lots of conversations like this about, gee, this is a big problem.
The final point is, though, if Walker's bill were to become law, if we were to mandate and allow that athletes would receive, you know, they could market their images, whatever, they could, that is officially the end of amateur athletics in college sports. I mean, the reality is they would be paid. And we know a lot of them are paid now, but I mean, that we wouldn't even have be pretending anymore. Those athletes would be paid. The other athletes would know about it. There would be competition. There would be recruiting based upon how big of a contract they could get with the shoe company or with the image marketers. And, you know, so it would just be out in the open. They would be officially, I think, professional athletes.
Final moment just from each of you. This will be for the podcast. Looking ahead to next week, what is one thing you are looking ahead to? It doesn't have to be in the world of politics, but I mean, if there's nothing in the political world that you're thinking of right now, what's something that listeners should be aware of heading into next week?
Go ahead, Becky.
Well, and if you want to say the ACC tournament, I mean, that's fine, too. Yeah, that's taking place next week.
I'm going to let you all cover the ACC tournament. You know, so much of my work is at the General Assembly, and so as this continues and things are really heating up, I mean, Jeff, you're down there a lot as well, and you know things, the tempo just really seems to be increasing. And I think we're going to continue to see the discussion of healthcare cost, whether it is the controversy between the state treasurer's proposal of how to bring costs down with the state employees' health plan, whether it's with Medicaid expansion, where that goes, what Republicans are going to do as far as proposals, what we've seen out of the governor's office. I think that's going to, you know, that is going to continue to be not just next week, but in the ensuing weeks.
Yeah, I think there may be, we might see some litigation next week that we shall be on the lookout for in the healthcare world. That's all I'll say about that. There will be continued discussion. We didn't mention that the governor had proposed Medicaid expansion. That issue continues, I think, to be the big dog in the political and legislative debate for 2019. I'm sure we'll see more reports, more introduction perhaps of legislation, more calls for Medicaid expansion. I feel like that debate's inevitably going to continue next week and for several weeks to come.
Jeff, since we're doing this on a Friday, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention another issue, and that's reforms of the alcohol beverage control system in North Carolina. That's getting a real serious look. And as the craft breweries continue to grow, as the wineries continue to grow, and what we're really seeing is distilleries, spirits industry in North Carolina is really growing. Entrepreneurs are investing money, creating jobs, creating some great products. And so since it's Friday afternoon, have a drink and think about North Carolina's ABC system and how it could be reformed so that there's more opportunity and more consumer choice.
Or check out the Policy Watch luncheon on the future of the death penalty next week. That, too, will be at ncpolicywatch.com.
And I will remind folks that, for me, next week, I think as we have our conversation, we will most likely be talking about the newest justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court. So a week from today, we'll be back to seven justices on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks.
Thanks, as always, for tuning into the podcast. You can subscribe to the program on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever it is that you get that on-demand listening. Plenty to come in the week of North Carolina politics. You can stay up to date at our website, wunc.org. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff.